from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. It's been almost 30 years since Ronald Reagan left the White House. Now a new 800-page biography traces Reagan's rise from humble roots in the Midwest to B-grade movie star, then using his Hollywood fame to transition into politics, first as California governor, then as president of the United States after defeating Jimmy Carter. Author Bob Spitz's new book is titled Reagan, An American Journey, and it includes new details of Reagan's private life, his controversial tenure as president of the Screen Actors Guild during the Hollywood blacklist era, and eyewitness accounts of his assassination attempt. He joins us for the hour. We'll get started right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. Well, until Donald Trump came along, the Republican Party belonged to Ronald Reagan, and that was true long after he died. Reagan parlayed a B-grade Hollywood movie career into a political movement that culminated in the White House, where he championed tax cuts, smaller government, a massive defense buildup, and later a surprise arms reduction treaty with the Soviet Union. His life is now chronicled in great detail in the new book titled Reagan, An American Journey. It's written by best-selling biographer Bob Spitz, who joins us for the hour. Welcome.
Great. Nice to see you, Scott.
Well, looking through your previous work, we're just talking about the Beatles, Bob Dylan. You wrote a book about Julia Child. This is a departure for you.
Yeah.
Why? Why did you decide to write this?
Well, when I was finished with writing about Julia Child, I was looking for another subject. And my wife said, you know, there's a thread through all of your work, and that is that all the subjects are both beloved and they have changed the culture. And we set about trying to look at a list of people who combine both of those elements. And we tried for 6 months. We couldn't come up with anybody. I mean, it's really a very slim category. And so finally she said to me, what about Ronald Reagan? And I went, absolutely not. I mean, I'm a lifelong Democrat. I don't think I've ever voted. I've never voted for a Republican. I can say that. But the more I thought about it, I realized that Reagan was definitely a beloved to many, many people in this country. And certainly he changed our political culture. And I thought that would be a real challenge for me to put aside any partisan take that I might have, and to be objective, and you know, my Democratic friends thought that I had betrayed the cause, and my Republican friends, and I have more Republican friends than you might imagine. Both of my Republican friends thought that I wouldn't have the objectivity, and so that was a challenge for me, and I really set about trying to see if I could bring him to life.
How did some of your preconceived notions about Reagan change in the course of writing this?
Well, you know, it's interesting. People ask me if I would vote for Reagan now after spending 6 years of my life working on this book.
Or some say he's too liberal to get the nomination of the current Republican Party.
Perhaps that's true. I wouldn't vote for him now because, you know, I'm a Democrat. I don't adhere to his politics. Yet, my perception did change because I came to really admire him as a man and his leadership capabilities in this country. And as George Shultz said to me, you know, his most endearing aspect is his fundamental decency. And I really think that's true about the man. He really had the American people at the forefront of his vision.
Certainly wasn't in politics, I don't think, to enrich himself.
Oh, absolutely not. And as a matter of fact, he is one of those people who declared his IRS forms to the American public, and he put all of his finances in a blind trust. The day he entered office, he never saw them again until he left.
He, of course, has deep California roots, but he was born in the Midwest, raised in a small Illinois town, Dixon, Illinois.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Talk about his family, because I know, and you write about his father, Jack, being a binge drinker and alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah.
What impact did all that and the place he was raised have on him?
Yeah, well, he came from really humble background. His family lived in a series of fly-spec Midwestern towns, and they often had to move under the cover of night when the rent came due. Jack couldn't hold a job because of his alcoholism. And his mom was a very, very pious woman who was deeply involved with the church. So Reagan, while loved by his parents, and they did love him, was largely ignored by them as well. And in fact, a famous story, he couldn't see. I mean, from the time he was born until he was about 12, he couldn't catch a fly ball. He couldn't see the blackboard in school, and he thought that something was wrong with him. And then one day he accidentally picked up his mom's glasses, and lo and behold, everything cleared up for him. So he was, I mean, those were parents who should have known, you know, take your kid to the optometrist, get him some glasses.
Oh, it's funny. I've never seen a picture of Reagan wearing glasses.
He wore contact lenses very early on, but he wore glasses out of the public eye. The minute he was out of the public eye, he put his glasses back on. That said, his father instilled in him liberal politics. He grew up a Democrat. He was an FDR loyalist all the way through until his career in Hollywood started to tank and everything changed. But, you know, he grew up with a real Midwestern soul.
There was in Reagan, people saw throughout his life the great difficulty of getting close to him emotionally. And it was thought that perhaps one of the very few, if not the only people, including his children, who could do that was his wife, Nancy.
Yes, without a doubt. And this began very early in his life because he really had to fend for himself as a young man. He had no friends. I think he was suspicious of getting too close to people because he saw that he could love them and be hurt by them. By the time he is president of the United States, as you said, the only person who was close to him was Nancy. He had no personal friends in college. He had, you know, ephemeral social friends, but nobody he ever hung out with
confided in or was emotionally close to.
Right, exactly right. And of course, his children suffered because of that.
Yeah. And it's funny because he did, of course, lead such a movement. He was so charismatic leading up through the 60s and while he was governor. Yeah. And then, of course, when he ran for and became president. And yet there was that distance between him. And people, I think, felt close to him in some ways, especially the people who supported him. But in fact, there was that distance. All
the time. And I think that's why he was so comfortable being in the movies, because he could play a character, but he didn't have to connect with people on the other side of that camera. And even when he was a president, he could look into the camera and talk to the nation and be very charming and very sentimental. But there was no deep personal connection that he had there.
Was it just performance?
It was performance, and I think it was self-protection in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And so he comes to California, I think, in 1937. Wentz goes
right
to school at Eureka College in the Midwest.
Yes, which I am headed there very shortly.
Oh, really? To give a talk about
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Is he a big deal on campus? He must be.
He is a big deal.
I'm sure he's
on
the
campus.
Only known graduate of Eureka College.
Yeah, without a doubt he is. And, you know, he should not have been at that college. It was a modest school, but way above his station. He had no money to get into school. In fact, he wasn't headed to college. His father told him he couldn't afford to send him. So Reagan just really took his girlfriend there to help her unpack and get settled. And he took a look around and he thought, there is no way I am leaving. So he made a beeline for the dean's office. And on the spot, he convinced the dean to give him a scholarship, a special Ronald Reagan scholarship.
Those were the days, right?
You bet. And then he worked his way through college, holding 4, 5, 6 jobs at a time.
What kind of student was he?
C's and D's. I was really lucky to see his report cards. They had them there, and they hadn't shown them to people before. But I got a really good look at them, and even in things like politics, he got D's.
Really? Was that because he was goofing around, or what was the?
You know, he was involved. He was the campus big man. You know, he was on the swim team. In fact, he was the swim team. He was on the football team. He was in the acting troupe.
But you said he didn't have any friends. These were just sort of people he hung out with, and they weren't really true friends.
They weren't true friends. In fact, he lived in a fraternity house, but he wasn't friendly with any of the brothers. You know, he was just there. And I think even his colleagues who were closest to him in Washington, Ed Meese and Mike Deaver, they never socialized with him at all.
Yeah. And it's in college that he gets into radio.
Yes, in a very big way, a bigger way than people imagine. And this was, I think, one of the most enjoyable parts of writing, because Reagan, like he didn't belong in college, he had no experience to say that he was going to be a radio announcer. Gets a job in a small station in Iowa, and becomes, and in just a short time, the voice of the Midwest. I mean, eight states listened to Dutch Reagan every night. He was a celebrity wherever he went. And if that had only been his career, it would have been enough, because he loved it and they loved him.
Mm. He had the nickname Dutch, as you say, until he got to Hollywood when he became Ronald or Ronnie. Where did that nickname come from?
You know, there's so many apocryphal stories, but I found a letter that Reagan had handwritten to somebody who was a friend from Dixon. And he said in the letter, no matter what you hear, it came about because he had a little Dutch boy haircut. And his father referred to him as Dutch, and it stuck. And his brother was Moon.
Dutch and Moon.
Yeah.
So he comes out to California, as I said earlier, I think in 1937, 26 years old. He's got a, you know, sort of an, he comes intentionally to go to Hollywood, right?
Well, actually, he went out there to, he was doing the Cubs games for the radio station in Des Moines. And he accompanied the Cubs to spring training in Catalina Island. And while he was there, he thought, you know, I'm just going to see if I can get a screen test. This is one of the great parts of the Reagan story. You know, he didn't belong in college. He didn't belong on the radio. He certainly had no experience to think that he could be a Hollywood movie star. But he goes to he gets an agent to at least talk to him, and the agent takes him over to Warner Brothers. He does a screen test, and he leaves Hollywood with the Cubs with a contract in his hand. I was lucky enough to have a source who told me all about his time in Hollywood, who was actually there with him. And I had been corresponding with this source on and off, I guess, for about a year. And I they were in Paris. And I finally said, I'm headed over to Paris. Can I talk to you in person? So I got to spend 3.5 hours with Olivia de Havilland.
Wow.
And, and she doesn't see people, but she wanted to talk about Ronald Reagan's life. And she had started the Screen Actors Guild with him. She had all of her notes. She had, I mean, she was more lucid than you and me, Scott. It really incredible that this woman had a fantastic memory.
Yeah. And her take on Ronald Reagan, like, what did she tell you that you didn't know or you hadn't heard from anybody else?
Well, a lot of it had to do with the blacklist and Reagan's position as president of the Screen Actors Guild.
This is during the McCarthy era, the HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yeah. Exactly right. And she was with him on many committees that were left-leaning during those days. And so she was able to really talk me through how Reagan kind of woke up to the fact that he was flirting with joining the Communist Party. The actor Eddie Arnold had to talk him out of it. And, I mean, that's how close Reagan was to doing it.
And that was because why? That's what he believed? Or
yeah,
he was impressionable?
Sure.
Or what?
Oh, no, no. He believed in the rights of the working man, the rights of the downtrodden. I mean, all the classic FDR policy. And, you know, he was a, at this point, for me, he was a liberal biographer's heartthrob. but, you know, he starts to see, and she took me through this, that the real communists were poisoning the well, and they were separating themselves from the democratic liberals, and really causing a lot of the unrest in Hollywood. And that's when Reagan begins to pull away and he starts to skew to the right.
Hmm. Talking with Bob Spitz, his new biography is titled Reagan, An American Journey. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim. And one of the things, of course, one of the big moments for Ronald Reagan in Hollywood was falling in love and marrying Jane Wyman, who broke his heart in a way.
She did break his heart. I mean, and his spirit in a lot of ways as well. That marriage was a typical Hollywood marriage. They didn't know much about each other. They were both working separately in different movies. For a while, they rarely saw each other. But really, what drove that marriage apart was the fact that Reagan would never shut up about politics. It drove Jane Wyman crazy. If he was on the set and there was a break in the takes, Reagan would pull cast members together and talk politics. If they went into the commissary for lunch, the actors would wait to see where he sat down first so they didn't have to get an earful of politics through lunch.
And at that point, his politics were what?
Oh, they were to the left.
They were
really Democratic politics. Yeah, and Jane Wyman couldn't take it anymore.
I remember when Reagan was running for president, there were bumper stickers that said, Jane Wyman was right.
Well, there you have it. Yeah.
So he, at some point, they get divorced, but they've had a couple kids.
Yes.
Michael and Maureen, right?
Yes. Michael they adopted, and Maureen was a natural child. And they...
I'm curious, why did they adopt Michael? Do you know what the story with that is?
You know what? Nobody knows. I think Jane found out that she couldn't have children again. That was my guess. But I have no idea why they adopted Michael. And they always said, you know, there are too many children in the world, we should adopt. But nobody ever knew personally why they did that.
And they had a difficult relationship, I think, Michael and his father.
All through his life. I mean, it never stopped. Nancy really wanted nothing to do with Michael and Maureen. And in fact, there's quite an interesting story. When Michael was graduating from high school, Ronald Reagan was the speaker. And as Michael comes up to get his diploma, Reagan gives him the diploma, shakes his hand and says, "And what is your name, young man?" And he looks up and he says, "Dad, it's me. It's Michael." And that really sums up their relationship.
Wow, maybe he wasn't wearing his glasses.
Yeah.
So his big break, if there was one, in Hollywood, because he really never broke out in the way a lot of stars did of that era, but he plays Newt Rockne, the Gipper, in 1940. How did he get that role? And what did he make of it?
Yeah, the producer absolutely didn't want Reagan. He wanted anybody but Reagan, because Reagan wasn't a star. They really wanted a star. So what Reagan did was he suited up in his old college uniform. He went into the producer's office unannounced, and he threw a few bullet passes in his old college day form. And the producer said, okay, you know, actually, he wanted to play Newt, but he got the Gipper, never really realizing that the real Gipper was a reprobate. You know, he smoked, he drank. He had illegitimate children. He gambled on his own games that he played in. So they kind of whitewashed that. But Reagan loved that role. I think
And, of course, the nickname stuck.
Yeah, the nickname stuck, the Gipper. But I think he only had two roles that he was really proud of. It was that and, of course, King's Row.
He becomes Screen Actors Guild president in 1947.
Yeah.
Even at that point, I think he was still a Democrat, right? He was supporting Harry Truman, I believe.
Yes.
So what was it that flipped the switch for him?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting story. He was friends with Dick Powell and Robert Montgomery, both of whom were real conservative Republicans. And they used to argue like cats and dogs all the time about politics. Reagan never really adhered to what they were saying until he went in the service. He worked in Hollywood. He was in the service in Hollywood making films for servicemen, training films. And he had heard while he was in the Army that those who were in the Army in World War I were forgiven their taxes when they came out. So Reagan decides, you know, I'm not going to pay my taxes because I'm sure they will forgive us when we get out. And, of course, he was completely wrong and wound up with a tax bill to Uncle Sam for $90,000. In those days, an incredible amount of money. At that point, Ronald Reagan feels that the government has its hand in his pocket, and he starts to talk about two things: big government, which he despises now, and paying taxes, which for the rest of his life he wanted to cut taxes. And so at this point, Dick Powell and Robert Montgomery start to really they start to come on to him and fashion him, and he starts to hear what they're saying and gradually goes over to their side.
Well, and his career fades out, and he makes the transition to the national stage through General Electric. They
yes.
hire him to be a spokesman, and he goes around the country giving speeches with some of the themes that you describe.
You know, I think it was his favorite job of his entire life. Yeah, he gets a job. Ostensibly, he's going to be the host of General Electric's new Sunday night dramatic anthology show. And he would come on and he would announce, you know, who's in the cast and tell you a little bit about it. But GE said, part of the job that we want is for you to be our ambassador. And you'll travel around to all the big plants where thousands of workers are working and just talk to them, see what's on their mind, talk to them about their lives. Reagan loved this. I mean, there he was talking to working class people, people very much like he grew up with. He understood them. He heard what they were saying. And these were people who became, you know, they were Democrats who became Reagan Republicans later on.
And fast forwarding into the 60s, he continues on this track, the Republican Party, and comes out as a big proponent of Barry Goldwater, who, of course, gets the nomination in 1964. Goldwater crashes and burns, but Reagan comes out smelling like a rose, as he often did.
Yeah, some very wealthy California businessmen who were behind Goldwater asked Reagan if he would give a speech on the candidate's behalf. And of course, this comes right at the time that Goldwater's candidacy is tanking. Reagan does it because he not only believes in Barry Goldwater, but Goldwater happens to live next door to Nancy's parents in Arizona, and they were friendly. So he gives this speech, and it's a rousing speech. Reagan wrote it himself, forever known as the speech. And the California businessmen watch this, and they say to themselves, the wrong man is on the ticket. And so they begin to groom Reagan for a run to governorship.
And, of course, he does run in 1966. And it's funny because people throughout his career underestimated Reagan. And Pat Brown, who was the incumbent governor, Jerry Brown's dad,
underestimated
him. And, in fact, worked behind the scenes to make sure Reagan got the nomination because he thought he'd be easier to beat than George Christopher, who
exactly.
was the mayor of San Francisco.
Right. Exactly right. And you know, Pat Brown, who was trying for a third term, really blew up the entire thing by telling school children on camera that, you know who shot Lincoln, don't you? An actor. And that really, that destroyed his candidacy.
Wow. All right, we're going to continue our conversation with Bob Spitz and his book, Reagan, An American Journey. We haven't even talked about his governorship or his presidency.
Right.
But we'd love to hear from you, your memories of Ronald Reagan and how they've changed. It's been 30 years since he left the White House. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments or questions to forum@kqed.org. And, of course, you can also send us a tweet. We're at KQED Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Munich Kim, and we're going to continue our conversation with Bob Spitz in just a minute. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Munich Kim, and my guest this hour is Bob Spitz. His new comprehensive biography is titled Reagan, An American Journey. We have a lot of folks who want to talk with you. We haven't, as I mentioned at the going into the break, Bob, we didn't even talk about his governorship, which lasted 8 years. And, of course, then he became president, challenged Gerald Ford in 1976
right.
at the convention, fell short. But then, of course, in 1980, gets the nomination. What was it about Reagan seemed to have a knack for timing in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
In 1966, when he ran for governor, people were getting tired of Pat Brown, and he ran on cleaning up the mess at Berkeley, the free speech movement, the student unrest there. What was it about the late 70s that cleared the way for Reagan?
Well, I think, you know, we had come through the Vietnam War. We had come through Watergate. We had come through a series of really a succession of seemingly failed presidencies. And Reagan's timing, again, you know, an actor's timing, he knew exactly who to talk to and how to talk to them. And once he got on camera, he knew how to turn on the charm. And I think all of those combinations brought people to his side, people who never thought of voting for a Republican before.
And, of course, you know, this kind of echoes back or harkens back to what he was saying or what you were saying about government being in your pocket. I mean, he ran as somebody who thought government was part of the problem, not part of the solution. That we needed smaller government, fewer taxes, cut the bureaucracy, and so on.
And that appealed to a lot of people, not just people who were feeling the squeeze economically, but people who didn't understand why we had to take care of people who were homeless, why we had to really support welfare. They really felt, you know, they were struggling. These people should struggle and pull themselves up as well. And I hate to say it, but those were the people who were attracted to Ronald Reagan.
Well, and not unlike the current occupant of the White House, he would tell stories, knowing, or maybe he didn't know, but they were often not true.
He knew.
Like, yeah, there was the famous welfare queen story he would tell time and again.
He did. There was a woman in Chicago, supposedly, who and they told him, look, you know, that story is just blown way out of proportion. There were a couple stories like that. But he continued to tell them because they got a big reaction from people. And he knew that those stories would pull people to his side.
All right, we're going to go to the phones. Lots of folks want to weigh in on this. Again, number, the number 866-733-6786, and we'll begin in Corte Madera. And Jane, welcome.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I was born in 1930, and when I was a teenager, Ronald Reagan was my big crush. And my question is, when did Reagan change to Reagan? Because we all knew him when we were kids as Ronald Reagan. And as a matter of fact, I was at a cocktail party as an adult, and he was there, and I was about arm's length away from him, never spoke to him, but I saw how much makeup he had on his face, and that's when my crush crashed. So if you could talk about when he went from Reagan to Reagan, I'd like to hear about it.
You know, I think basically that happened when he went to Hollywood. Jack Warner really was instrumental in shaping a persona for his new young actor. And he wanted everything to sound well. You know, they were looking for a name for him. He really came to Hollywood thinking he'd be Dutch Reagan on the screen, or Dutch Reagan, as you're pointing out. But they went through a litany of names, and finally somebody said, well, what about Ronald? And Jack Warner went, oh, that's perfect.
That is his name.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thanks, Jane, for the comment. Let's go now to Alameda and Tom. Welcome.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask a question. Why is there a change after 40 years and attempt to rehabilitate Reagan, the man? Even though his personality is different from the current occupant of the White House, he was not known as a sexual harasser. Their personality and self-delusion is somewhat similar in that
in, Bob, they also have backgrounds similar coming from television.
Yes,
and
exactly.
They didn't really have reality TV back then, but, you know.
Right.
Had they had reality TV, there might have been a Ronald Reagan show. But I think here's the one thing that's different that people, I think, are grabbing hold of when they look back at Reagan. Even if you didn't subscribe to his policies, like I don't subscribe to his policies, Reagan was a uniter, not a divider. And he really believed in the goodness of the American people. And I think perhaps, you know, people are, if you want to say, fooling themselves now about Reagan's legacy, you could use that word. But I think people are looking at that wistfully, thinking, boy, we could really use somebody now who at least told the American people that they were good people, that we shouldn't be hostile towards one another.
He didn't demonize immigrants. In fact, he signed amnesty. And he called it amnesty for undocumented immigrants.
Exactly right. And, you know, he gave that famous speech. It was the last speech before he left the White House, in which he talked about that shiny city on the hill. And he said, you know, it was a metaphor for America. And if the cities had to have walls, then the walls should have doors, and that anybody who wanted to live in peace and harmony should be able to come through those doors. So I think people are latching onto that when they look back at Reagan.
But Tom makes a good point that, you know, he was tried to cut government. I don't know that he really did. I mean,
he didn't. And his financial programs really never worked either. The Republicans like to say he was, you know, he really changed finances, our budget for the better. But our budget really tanked, and we had In terms of the deficit. And for years afterwards, I mean, we were, you know, up in 11, 12, 18% interest rates.
Yeah, and of course, he inherited a mess from Jimmy Carter. The economy, like you said, the interest rates were through the roof.
Right.
Unemployment was, and that was part of the reason he got elected, of course.
You know, and his trickle-down economics didn't work either.
You know, one thing that is sometimes forgotten in the sort of gauzy remembrances of Reagan is what he didn't do, and that is the AIDS epidemic. And he went six years at least, before he even used the word, and that was about all he did.
Yeah, you know, I was in Houston yesterday, and somebody asked me if there was one thing that Reagan was the least proud of, what would it be? And it's absolutely that he was tone deaf about AIDS.
He felt bad about that?
Yes, because after he leaves office, somebody from Hollywood introduced him to Elizabeth Glazer, the wife of the stars Starsky and Hutch, and she was dying of AIDS. Her young daughter had died of AIDS because at childbirth she had become infected through a transfusion. And Reagan was turned inside out, and he and Nancy, for a short period of time, as it was all that they could do at that point in their lives, they gave a lot of money to AIDS research, and they also went on TV as a spokesperson, but it was too late, too soon.
Well, but how, given he was in Hollywood, I mean, Rock Hudson came out with HIV, I think, in 1985.
Yeah, but Reagan never believed that Rock Hudson was gay. I mean, he really...
Well, what difference did that make?
I don't know.
But, I mean, are you saying, so for Reagan, was the difficulty he had in talking about it the fact that it was largely affecting gay men?
He completely believed it was a disease that only affected gay men. And he and in fact, Pat Buchanan, who was in his administration, said to him quite infamously, it's no more than measles. And so they ignored it. I mean, they completely ignored it.
Well, and as you write in the book, I think he tried to cut the budget for AIDS in 86.
He did. And in fact, in his 86 address to the nation, he is about to say something about AIDS, looks at his notes and just skips right over it.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Pat in Sacramento, welcome.
Yes, I was a programmer for the State Department of Social Welfare when Reagan was governor.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government gave an increase to the welfare recipients. He refused to transfer it to them, and they had to sue. It took them about 3 years to get the money.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right about that. He, like with the AIDS epidemic, he is tone deaf about people's neediness. Reagan believed that he pulled himself up by his bootstraps. Why shouldn't everybody be able to do the same thing? And, you know, that was incredibly short-sighted of him, very short-sighted.
At the same time, he signed a bill, which he later regretted, liberalizing abortion in California.
Yeah, really fascinating. You know, why? He was against abortion. So I called the late Tony Billinson, who was the assemblyman from Beverly Hills, who sponsored that bill. And he told me, yep, Reagan absolutely was opposed to abortion. But Tony told him that the studies they had done showed that 65% of people in California favored therapeutic abortion. So Reagan read those studies, and he said to Billinson, you know, I'm opposed to it, but I'm governor of all the people of California, not just some of the people. And so I'm going to sign this bill. He regretted it for the rest of his life, but he did it. And I thought that was remarkable. Governor of all the people of California.
Yeah, and I think it wasn't his father-in-law, Nancy's father, was
right.
also a physician who gave him advice on that issue and told him to sign it as well.
Yeah, exactly right. And Nancy was in favor of it, as she was throughout her life.
Yeah. All right. Let's go now to Leah in Berkeley. Welcome.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go right ahead.
Yeah. So my comment is every time I pass a mentally ill homeless person on the streets, I think to myself, well, that's Reagan's legacy.
Yeah, that is certainly how many people feel. And Bob, I mean, he signed the bill that closed the mental institutions,
yes.
which at the time, I believe, was seen as a compassionate thing. The problem was there was nothing that came after it to fund programs and other alternatives.
Right. It was one of the first things he did as governor, as a matter of fact. And it was a disaster. He realized too late again that you can't just slash budgets without worrying about the repercussions. But as I said, it was too late. It really
was. It primarily because he wanted to cut the budget?
Yeah, he wanted to cut the budget 10% across everything. But they convinced him early on that that the mental institutions really could be slashed further than that.
Well, and ironically, who tried to shoot him and kill him, who did shoot him and kill and tried
yes,
to kill
somebody
him.
Somebody who was mentally deranged.
Who had mental health problems himself.
Yeah.
All right, Leah, thanks very much. Let's read some comments here. We asked folks on social media what they considered Reagan's enduring impact. A couple of responses here. Curtis says, to me, Reagan is synonymous with the me generation. D tweets the budget deficit, which you alluded to, Bob.
Yep.
And then another listener says, trickle down economics. America was duped into believing it would benefit the average worker. Trump passed a similar bill and credited the wisdom of Reagan.
Yeah.
Workers have yet to benefit.
Yeah, really. I mean, you know, David Stockman famously came
OMB
up with
director.
That plan. Yeah, and convinced Reagan that supply side economics, something that no economist in America really believed in, was the answer to all of our problems. I guess about a year and a half later, Stockman realized that it was completely wrong, and he gave a very famous interview to The Atlantic. Which they called The Education of David Stockman. And it basically hung the policy out to dry right in front of the president. They had no idea this was coming. And Stockman almost lost his job over it.
One of the criticisms of Ronald Reagan was that he was sort of detached from the job, that he wasn't really paying close attention, that he, you know, would go upstairs and put on his pajamas at 6:30 or 7, whatever time it was, and watch Bonanza, or 5:30,
yeah.
you know, and watch Bonanza reruns of Mission Impossible. I mean, was that...
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it wasn't just that he was detached. He didn't understand a lot of the policy. I always like to say that Ronald Reagan wasn't a deep thinker, but his thinking was deeply felt. I think one of his strong points is that he was humble enough to know that he didn't understand complex issues. So he hired very good people. It's the one thing that Trump has not done. But I will say, Reagan hired experts to give him advice, and he was smart enough to listen to them.
One of the things, of course, Reagan was best known for was his ability to give speeches.
Mm-hmm.
He gave some great speeches, and one of the speeches he gave was in 1986 when the space the Challenger disaster happened, blew up upon launch, and he gave a speech that really united the country. Let's listen to this, one of the more famous lines.
Yeah.
The crew of the space shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of earth to touch the face of God.
That speech, of course, famously written by Peggy Noonan,
right.
His speechwriter. Did Reagan see the presidency largely as a performance?
Well, you know, the one thing he knew how to do is use soaring rhetoric. We hear it in that speech. He knows what's going to connect with the people. And I think that being an actor, and we're seeing it now, currently, reaches people who either aren't well-versed in politics, but they appreciate the performance.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And again, the number is 866-733-6786 if you have a question or comment for Bob Spitz. And we'll go to Palo Alto. John, welcome.
Hello. I find it really ironic that many of the things that are being said about Trump today were said about Reagan. They called Reagan a dunce, a warmonger, reactionary, he's divisive, he's going to set off World War III, et cetera, et cetera. I vividly remember that, and the rallies, millions of people across Europe, United States, Central Park, et cetera, saying Reagan is going to set off World War III, and of course, and this is his real legacy, far more important than anything your callers have talked about, was that he actually did the opposite. He brought the Cold War to a successful and peaceful conclusion. And again, ironically, Trump is likely to do the same thing with regard to the nuclear standoff in North Korea. So it's funny how people's memories are so selective.
Yeah, well, I think it's a little soon to write Trump's history. But
really.
But Reagan, of course, did come in as a cold warrior. And it's kind of a Nixon goes to China sort of thing where he and Gorbachev really hit it off. Before you respond to that, I just want to play a cut from Reagan. This is a very famous speech he gave in 1987 at the Brandenburg Gate.
General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
And the wall came down a couple years later.
Yeah, it was a coincidence.
Because he does, you know, a lot of people say, oh, yes, it's because it was Star Wars and it threw the Soviet Union into bankruptcy. But
your caller was right. I mean, you know, Reagan came into office as Ronnie Reagan.
G-U-N.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, famously saber-rattling and calling the Soviet Union the evil empire. But, you know, when I wrote my biography of the Beatles, I knew that the boogeyman in that book was Yoko Ono. And I was wrong about that there. But I saw the boogeyman in this book being Nancy Reagan. I said, she's the Yoko Ono of my story. And in fact, believe it or not, I was wrong again, because Nancy Reagan had only one thing on her mind throughout the 8 years, and that was that her husband's legacy should be a man of peace. And she pushed him over and over and she nagged him, make peace with the Soviet Union. It will be the strongest thing you can do. He came close. They came very close in Reykjavik to abandoning all nuclear development. But Reagan stubbornly walked away from it at the last minute.
And how did Nancy Reagan, how did the people around the president deal with her? Because obviously, in some ways, you know, as they say, she has the last word at night, the last person to talk to him before he goes to sleep. You know, how did they deal with this very powerful influence on him, who many of whom I'm sure disagreed with?
Oh, without a doubt. Well, she created difficulty in the Oval Office. But he listened to her. I mean, he really felt that she gave him the best advice of all of his advisors. And she was really the eminence grise in the Ronald Reagan story.
And in that part of it there with Gorbachev, I mean, was it because she was thinking about his legacy or was it because she felt that was the right thing to do?
You know, I think a little bit of both. She was someone who wanted... who thought mutually assured destruction was a crazy policy, and really talked to him quite a lot about it.
All right, let's go now to San Francisco. Crystal, you're on. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? So I wasn't alive when Ronald Reagan was around, but, you know, recent shows on like Narcos on Netflix kind of bring light to the war on drugs era and how that affected Latin American countries and how they look at Reagan as kind of overimposing on that.
Yeah, and then, of course, that was another Nancy Reagan legacy, is just say no.
Yeah, really. It was, it was kind of a tone-deaf policy.
But Central America figures big in his presidency.
Right. In fact, his Central America policy, which evolves into Iran-Contra, really torpedoes his second term completely. He gets embroiled in it, not really knowing what he's getting involved in.
And just remind everyone what that was. It was a deal with Iran, sort of a three-way deal.
So it was against American law to send arms to the Contras in Nicaragua. So what they did was they traded missiles with Iran. They got a lot more money.
And they got them, I think, didn't they get them through Israel?
Through Israel, right. We couldn't give missiles to Iran, so Israel gave its stockpile of missiles we had given them to Iran, and we replenished Israel's stockpile. But we overcharged Iran for it, and what was ever left skimmed off the top was sent illegally to Nicaragua, to the Contras. And Reagan was talked into this. He was duped into it. But once he was duped into it, he ran with it. And people always ask me if he knew that this was illegal. And without a doubt, from my research, I can say he knew.
Well, and also you point out as that scandal unfolded and his advisors come to him to talk to him about what happened and how he's going to talk about it. He has very little recollection of it, the details of conversations that he had, which may well have been the early signs of Alzheimer's.
You know, I would like to say that and whitewash it for him and give him a pass, but the truth of the matter is he knew.
Really?
He remembered.
It was willful.
But
ignorance.
Saying I don't remember was his way of ducking the question. And they let, for some reason, they let him get away with that. They
them
didn't
being...
press him. The committees that were, the Senate committees that were investigating.
Teflon president.
A Teflon president, yeah.
All right, let's go now to Chris in San Francisco. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering if you would agree that the most impactful legacy of Reagan today in 2018 is abandonment of principles of fiscal conservatism, which was obviously part and parcel to the demise of the Soviet Union. But it seems to me that gives license to guys like Trump today to add $1.8 trillion to our national debt, knowing that the general population thinks of that as sort of an esoteric issue, whether it's deficits or national debt or, you know, government borrowing. And the fact that the last president to preside over a balanced budget was a liberal Democrat in Bill Clinton seems to me as striking that you can call yourself a conservative and yet add this much to the national debt year in and year out. And that, to me, trails back to Ronald Reagan.
Well, and of course, you know, it seems like Republicans tend to care about deficits when Democrats are in the White House.
Yeah, that's true. But he used, you know, he built up the deficit by telling the country he was putting money into establishing or reestablishing our military industrial complex, and it was going to protect us. And so that, you know, they all Republicans tend to believe that when you put money into the military, it doesn't matter how much you put in and go into debt with.
All right, Chris, thanks for the call. We're going to go now to Hot Springs, South Dakota. Robert, welcome.
Hi, yes. I had a question about the meanness of Ronald Reagan. I remember seeing during like Saturday Night Live, they would have parodies of him, you know, going out to meet the Girl Scouts and being all happy, and then he'd go back into the Oval Office and he'd be like this charging bull with all of his cabinet and everything. And also, I saw this. It was a documentary, Berkeley in the '60s, and they showed quite a few clips of Reagan when the students had taken over some of the buildings there at Berkeley.
Yeah, we talked about that earlier.
Yeah.
But I never heard of Reagan being particularly mean.
Well, I think if you were homeless, if you think that—
Heartless, maybe.
Heartless. I think that's more or less what it is. But I tend to agree with George Shultz that his ineffable sense of decency and integrity really— was much more important.
Let's read some listener comments here. Alexander asks, can you ask Mr. Spitz to talk about how Reagan evolved from signing strict gun control laws in California as governor to being more pro-gun during his presidency?
Well, he listened to people and played to what they wanted, and he got a sense from talking to people, and especially when he was spokesperson for General Electric, that people like their guns. And it's what happened with the therapeutic abortion bill. You know, he decided that the most of the country were really interested in having a gun, and so he was going to support that from then on.
Another question from Bob, who writes, how do you explain that as governor, Reagan was pretty good on environmental issues, including signing the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, which
right.
is not beloved by many now, but lousy on the environment when he became president?
Yeah, well, you know, he took on James Watt as Secretary of the Interior, and it was a huge mistake. Watt was the one big mistake in his cabinet, the biggest mistake in his cabinet, and did a lot of damage, And it was kind of out of Reagan's control. But what Reagan wanted to do again with the environment was slashing the budget. Like what he did with governor and you know, the mental health bills. So that really gave him a different kind of viewpoint.
Yeah. Really short on time, I want to mention that you're going to be at, is it Rakestraw Books in
yes.
Danville? Rakestraw Books
yep.
tonight at 7 o'clock, talking about the book, Reagan, An American Journey. In the last seconds left, What should we take away from the book, do you think, and from, you know, your, after doing all this research on Reagan, what stands out for you?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things with all the listeners that we've had calling in, people who were for Reagan and against Reagan, I wrote this biography because people of both stripes should read it. It's a history. It tells us where we came from, who we are, and Reagan was an important part of our American history.
All right. Bob Spitz, again, the book is called Reagan, An American Journey, and you can also read his biographies of the Beatles and Bob
Julia
Dylan,
Child.
Julia Child
yeah.
as well. Thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Scott.
I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.